is a blessing to see the sunshine in one's eyes on the way in this morning, so that can definitely appreciate that. So I'll be doing a lesson in Mark chapter 1, verses 16 through 28, picking up from where Bill left off last week.
Hey Nathan, can you speak up just a little bit?
Sure, yeah. So last
saying that for somebody else.
Yeah. So last week, Bill introduced the first 15 verses of chapter 1, where John the Baptist is introduced as the forerunner to Christ, and then explained how Christ is our forerunner. We see Christ as a humble servant, the perfect example of what we should also strive to be. And he was baptized by John, something he didn't need to do, yet he was. And he did this in submission to the Father's plan to truly become one of us. The Father approved of his Son's submission in verses 10 and 11, where we see the heavens parting and the Spirit descending upon Jesus like a dove, with a voice from heaven saying, "You are my beloved Son, with you I am well pleased." And in Mark's quick moving narrative, we see the Spirit immediately drives Jesus into the wilderness for 40 days, where he's not only tempted by Satan, but he's in the midst of wild animals, it says. And we see one of the first contrasts in Mark, contrasting Adam with Jesus. Adam, as we know, was created as a man and placed into a very perfect world. There was no sin, there was no pain, there were no wild animals trying to kill him in the wilderness, and yet Adam fails big time. Jesus, on the other hand, is born in a barn, in a fallen world where there's all kinds of sin. There's all kinds of pain. There are all kinds of wild animals trying to kill him. And Jesus succeeds, as we know. He accomplished what the first Adam couldn't and had to sacrifice his life to save us, the sinners. And let's also remember the original audience that Mark was writing for. It's commonly believed that Mark was written in Rome in the 60s. Not the 1960s, of course. Does anybody remember what's happening in Rome at that time? There was a lot of persecution. Nero was the emperor, and of course he persecuted Christians very heavily at that time. And so in the middle of chapter 1, when we see that John is arrested, we begin to think that that's kind of discouraging. But in the same verse, immediately, we see that hope is not lost. Jesus is here, and he's picking up where John left, and he will go all the way to the cross. And if that's where it ended, there's not a lot of hope there, but it doesn't end there. We know this, right? Jesus Christ conquered death. And this serves as a reminder to those persecuted Christians that the gospel is not hindered by adversity.
That's right.
The gospel is proclaimed by adversity. And in the end of verse 14, we read Jesus came into Galilee, proclaiming the gospel of God, and in 15, saying, "The time is fulfilled, and the kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe in the gospel." Two commands here from Jesus, repent and believe. And in reference to the gospel, proclaimed by Jesus and yet present in Jesus. And so that's where we pick it up this week. I'll be covering, again, verses 16 through 28. The title I've given for these two sections is "The Cost of Following Christ is Never Too High." And the theme is Jesus has authority over all. Very simple. And I have sort of a subtitle to this, whether we realize it or whether we recognize it or not. And it's actually a type of foreshadowing that we don't necessarily see here, but as we continue to go through Mark, that will become clearer. So we'll start with reading the text. Verse 16. Passing alongside the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, the brother of Simon, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And Jesus said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you become fishers of men." And immediately they left their nets and followed him. And going on a little farther, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who were in their boat, mending their nets. And immediately he called them, And they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants and followed him. And they went into Capernaum. And immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. And immediately there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit. And he cried out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." But Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be silent, and come out of him." And the unclean spirit, convulsing him, and crying out with a loud voice, came out of him. And they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, "What is this? A new teaching with authority. He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." And at once his fame spread everywhere throughout all the surrounding region of Galilee. So there are two distinct scenes here that we'll be discussing this morning. The first section, verses 16 through 20, tells the story of Jesus calling his first disciples. The second part, 21 through 28, tells a story of teaching in the synagogue in Capernaum and healing a man with an unclean spirit. So a bit of background. The book of Mark is unique in that it reads almost like a drive-by summary of Matthew and Luke. Lots of details that are included in those other books are not included in Mark. So when Mark does include specific details, we should take note of these details. One such detail is location. We'll find as we go through the study, Mark doesn't often include where his subjects are at any given time. Here, though, he clearly tells us where Jesus is. He's passing alongside the Sea of Galilee. And I drew a very detailed map here of the Sea of Galilee up here. So he's probably around here somewhere, but doesn't really tell us. So some facts about the Sea of Galilee. It's not really a sea, it's more of a lake. In fact, some of the Gospels, the writer calls it a lake. It's 7 miles wide and 13 miles long at its extremities, 33 miles in circumference, and its maximum depth is about 140 feet. A unique characteristic is it lies 700 feet below sea level, which makes it the lowest freshwater lake in the world, and the second lowest lake in the world, the first being the Dead Sea, which is down at the bottom there, but of course that's a saltwater lake. Josephus, the Jewish historian, speaks very highly of Lake Galilee. He says, "Its pure sweet water and many species of fish, its fertile soil and pleasing climate that supplies fruit and produce 10 months of the year." So it sounds like a really good place to be. And the fishing industry in this area was very strong in the first century, and it continues to be this day. That was something I was wondering about, and it's still very strong there. Fish was a staple of the Mediterranean diet at the time, and fish caught from the Sea of Galilee would be sold not just locally, but exported to areas as far away as Egypt and Syria. I was wondering, well, how far away is Egypt and Syria from the Sea of Galilee? I didn't fit them on the map here. Egypt's probably down on the floor somewhere, and Syria is up there at the ceiling somewhere. So it's pretty far for that time of the world. So for a relatively small regional area to compete with the much larger Mediterranean fish market, we've got this huge Mediterranean Sea over here, this little Sea of Galilee. This isn't exactly to scale. There's some things going on there that required some savviness that we typically don't equate to fishermen at that time. These men whose livelihood depended on competing in this environment needed to be pretty good at what they did. They needed to be resourceful. They also would have needed a command of the Greek language, which was the universal language used in business at the time. So these men were not ignorant laborers who just threw nets in the water for a living. They were likely very shrewd and successful businessmen. And tough, hardworking men. One of the commentaries I read this week described the fishing method commonly used at that time in that area of the world. Listen to this. A circular net, some 20 feet in diameter, and with heavy bars of metal or rocks attached to the perimeter was cast into the water by a single fisherman, either by standing in the boat or wading in the water. He'd gather the net on his arm and heave it outward in a circular motion so that it would land like a parachute on the water, trapping fish as it sank to the bottom. Fish were then retrieved by the fisherman diving to the bottom, gathering the weights of the net together, and dragging the net and its catch to shore or a boat. Anybody ever fish that way or know that was an option? So if you don't like the worms, that's an option you have. So these fishermen that Jesus is strolling by on the shore of the Sea of Galilee are strong, hardworking, shrewd international businessmen. The one thing they aren't, at least they aren't described as such here, are students looking for a teacher. But Christ calls out to them. He commands them to follow him, and they do. And this is not typical behavior for that time in the Jewish culture. Teachers or rabbis did not seek out and call prospective students. This actually doesn't happen as part of the Jewish tradition at all. Mark is emphasizing something here that's very important. In Mark's gospel, Jesus hasn't gained much attention yet. His ministry is just getting started. He hasn't performed any miracles. There's been no teaching. There's been no persuasion on his part for them to follow him. Remember, a student seeking to be mentored by a rabbi would have had to put forth a tremendous amount of effort to even have the hope of becoming such. And these fishermen did no such thing. And that's not like they were even on the shore or taking a break when he stopped by. The text says they were actually in the midst of their work. They were casting nets into the sea. They were mending their nets. And when Jesus called, they left them and followed him. I suspect that those nets sunk to the bottom of the lake, and that's where they stayed. They didn't pull them out, put them in a storage unit somewhere to be retrieved later if this discipleship thing didn't work out. No, they weren't going to need them anymore. They were with Jesus now. That is an act of faith. And this call to follow is rooted in Jesus' authority alone. These new disciples didn't need the in-depth knowledge of the Torah to do what they needed to do. They only needed to follow Jesus, the authoritative call of Jesus. And the contrast here is clear. Jesus is calling people from their world, the world that they live in, the shores of the sea, the cubicle and the office. That's where discipleship begins. The only thing they can do is to respond to that authority of Jesus because of who he is. And what is this response? What are they being called to do? Well, in verse 17, Jesus gives the answer to that as he first calls Simon and Andrew. He says, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." This call implied the need for commitment, intensive training, and exposure to dangerous circumstances, analogous to their current jobs, but with a much higher calling. Fishers of men. Men implies a worldwide scope, not just the Galilean region that they currently inhabited, as shown here. And they're not being called to do anything by themselves. They're called to be subordinates to Jesus so as to bear witness of him. They are called to be disciples, and their acceptance, as recorded here, is implied to be instant and complete. Something to note, while chapter 1 and chapter 3 of John's Gospel insinuates that Simon and Andrew had already met Jesus and had accepted him as Messiah, this is not the emphasis in the story that Mark is telling. Mark's focus is on Jesus initiating the call to discipleship and those he calls to respond. This is a main focus of the book of Mark, and sometimes the response, as here, is the right response, and other times it's not. So while the story is the same in both Gospels, Mark includes certain details here, omits certain details here, in order to emphasize the point he wants to make. And this is just one example of the supernatural genius of the Scriptures, in this case the Gospels, weaving this tapestry, the same story told by different people in different ways to emphasize different and specific events and things and ideas, all for his glory. I think that's amazing. So back to discipleship. Being a disciple of Christ requires the things of God to be put ahead way ahead of the things of self. And you can see the escalation that Mark alludes to here just in his storytelling. The subtle hint of the cost of following Jesus. While Simon and Andrew left their nets in the sea, James and John left their father and servants behind. This indicates a bigger operation, a fishing operation, than what Simon and Andrew were running. Perhaps James and John weren't the ones diving to the bottom of the lake to retrieve their fish-filled nets. They had people to do that. They just needed to keep the nets in good condition and manage the books. If they were able to afford a staff, perhaps they were quite wealthy. So to recap, two aspects of the call to Christian discipleship. And these verses are witnesses to the first disciples. Number one, Jesus and who Jesus is must be the subject of the call. This is the basis for everything else. If it's not, then this is just another quaint story. Number two, it is a call to service. Putting the things of God ahead of the things of self. This is a pillar of the Christian life. And we're seeing clear, practical examples of it in this text. Powerful examples. I can't help but think of this and people that I have met over the years in my life. I think of the pastors here, right? These are quality men that could do anything, really. And they're here. They've been called to do something, and they answered that call. So I'm humbled to have people like that in my life. God has blessed us immensely in that regard. But every moment of their lives, just like the fishermen, prepared them to be what they are today and do what God has called them to do for His glory. Remember, again, the original audience of Mark's gospel, those Christians in Nero's Rome being persecuted daily, wondering if this would be the day they get taken away from their families. How might they relate to what's happening in their lives to the apostles? They willingly left their livelihoods, their homes, their families to follow Jesus. Of course, this is just the beginning of the book, but you can already see Mark setting the table for what's to come. So in the first scene here, verses 16 through 20, we see Jesus calling the first disciples. We see what it costs for these disciples to follow Jesus. So where does Mark take us next? Well, he takes us to another specific place, Capernaum. And Capernaum is in the northwest corner, right off the shores of the Sea of Galilee. Again, details in Mark, like location, are important, and Capernaum is one of the few specific places that Mark mentions again. It was adjacent to the Via Maris, which was the main trade route between the Mediterranean coastal plain and Damascus in the north. Most of the inhabitants were Jews who labored as fishermen, farmers, artisans, merchants, and officials. It was also home to a garrison of Roman soldiers, which I'm told the Roman soldiers actually lived better than the inhabitants of Capernaum. The advantages of a location on a major trade route, surrounded by fertile lands and plentiful fishing, make it a fairly prosperous town, prosperous enough to have a synagogue. And unlike the temple in Jerusalem, where sacrifices were made, Jewish synagogues were assembly halls where people would gather and the Torah would be read and expounded. So there was only one temple in Jerusalem, but there were many synagogues throughout the Mediterranean region for worship and instruction. The text reads in verse 21, "And they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue and was teaching," he being Jesus, of course. So we know where Jesus is. He's in Capernaum. We know who he's with him. They, indicating the four disciples that he called previously, Simon, Andrew, James, and John. We also see the use of the word immediately again. You'll see it's used like three times just in this small passage. In verse 18, immediately they left their nets, referring to Simon and Andrew. Verse 20, immediately he called them, James and John. Mark uses this repetition again to emphasize the urgency of Jesus' ministry. He's calling disciples, and they immediately leave their nets. He sees more disciples, and he immediately calls them to follow him. This could have happened the day before, calling the disciples, and it was now the Sabbath, we're told, And Jesus is immediately teaching in the synagogue. So you can kind of picture the scene here. He picks up these guys along the shore of the Sea of Galilee. He says, hey, we're going to Capernaum. It's 10 miles up the shore here. They're thinking, okay, yeah, let's go. Let's get up there. It's less than 24 hours, possibly, that they're together. There's really no time to organize their strategy or what they're doing next. They show up at the synagogue, and all of a sudden, Jesus is preaching. So the disciples say, okay, well, I guess we're going to stay here a while. Let's settle in. And in the very next verse, verse 22, it says they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. And so after rushing up here to Capernaum, wondering what they're going to do, things start to become a little more focused. Disciples are sitting there thinking, yeah, wow, we made the right choice to follow this guy. So as I was studying this, I was kind of wondering who would typically be teaching in the synagogue at any given time, and was there anything different that would be happening on the Sabbath? And here's what I found. The only official in charge of the synagogue was called the ruler of the synagogue. And this guy had a lot of responsibility. He was the librarian. He was the worship committee. He was a custodian. He was a school teacher during the weekdays. But there was no preaching done by him. There was no exposition of the Torah. Typically, the Sabbath teaching and exposition fell to the laity. And on this occasion, that was Jesus. So it wasn't unusual to hear lay preachers on Sabbath morning expositing the Torah. So Jesus being there teaching wasn't unusual at all. What was unusual was that he was saying what he was saying and the way he was saying it. Astonished is used in the ESV text. Some other descriptions and other translations are completely amazed, wondered on, marveled, astounded. One commentator even used the word thunderstruck. So think of the most magnificent thing you've ever heard or experienced and the feeling you got from experiencing that. And Jesus' preaching was so much better than that. At the end of verse 22, he gives us the probable standard of what Jesus' teaching might have been compared to, the scribes. So I'm like, okay, well, let's do some research here on what the scribes were. And I knew a little bit about them. I've definitely heard of them, but I didn't know a lot about them. So primarily, scribes were experts in the Torah. And more importantly, they were capable of issuing binding decisions on its interpretation. Torah knowledge and the means by which it was attained was often regarded as enlightenment and only offered to a select few. This made it more authoritative in the eyes of the Jews, of course. Secondly, scribes were teachers of the Torah. They were called rabbi, meaning great one. And thirdly, scribes were legal jurists in the very broad sense in the Jewish community. They were interpreting the Torah, and so they were looked at as legal jurists as well. So in our world, a scribe would be a Torah professor, a teacher, a moralist, and a civil lawyer. So quite a combination. But needless to say, these were prestigious individuals. They held authoritative positions. They were some of the select few that were permitted to enter the Sanhedrin. The first seats in the synagogues were reserved for them. People rose to their feet when they entered a room. So if these guys were so good, why did Jesus just recruit four fishermen to be his disciples? Seems like you should have checked out the synagogue first and recruited some scribes, right? They already know everything. They can hit the ground running. So we start seeing this contrast between Jesus and the scribes and the synagogue. In verse 23, Mark calls it their synagogue. They play opposing roles in much of Mark's gospel, as we'll see. The word that Mark uses to describe Jesus' teaching is that of authority. It's used several times. Exousia is the Greek word that Mark uses here. This word is often used to describe supernatural powers and authorities, especially God and his works. It was typically used to designate supernatural authority in literature immediately prior to the Christian tradition. Exousia. By using it here in the very first chapter, Mark is establishing Jesus' authority over the highest authorities in the earthly as well as the supernatural realms. And as we'll see in his interaction with the demon. So we should ask ourselves, what is the nature of authority? Where does it come from? The most basic answer to this is that it's inherited or appointed, typically from a higher authority. So where do the scribes get their authority? Mark tells us in chapter 7, verse 8 of Mark, in the tradition of men, referring to the fathers of Judaism. And that, of course, is based on the Torah, the authority of the Torah. Jesus, on the other hand, gets his authority directly from the Father in heaven. This is an immediate and superior authority in himself that he received at his baptism that we saw early on in chapter 1. So the astonishment of the people of Jesus' teaching at the synagogue is not because Jesus is a superior teacher to the scribes. It's that his teaching is qualitatively different. It's rooted in a different place. It's associated with supreme authority. Purposely, Mark, in general, doesn't focus on the subject of Jesus' teaching. And we'll see this throughout the study. It's not in this passage or others. We don't know what Jesus was teaching about this Sabbath morning. For Mark, the person of Jesus is more important than the subject of his teaching. Again, this is the beauty and depth of God's word right here before us. The scribes were, of course, teachers of the law. They had knowledge. As I explained, their knowledge was unsurpassed. But they were still just men. Jesus understood himself as the Son of God. He wasn't just a regular man. His authority came from being the triune God. There was never a man like this to walk the earth, and there will never be another one. He is God. He holds the power of the universe. And his teaching was conveying that power, that authority. And Jesus knew he had a clear purpose and task, which wasn't made known to those around him just yet, but we're getting there. Remember again, the original audience of Mark, persecuted Christians in Rome. Do you think these people were willing to suffer and give up their lives because Jesus was a great teacher? My Muslim colleagues at work believe that Jesus was a great teacher. If that's as far as we're willing to go to acknowledge who Jesus is, we might as well be Muslim. No, the Roman Christians needed to hear, to be reminded that the Jesus that they served held all authority under heaven, that nothing would happen to them that wasn't outside of his will for their lives. And having persevered, their reward would be great because of their steadfast faithfulness in him. Friends, being a follower of Christ is worth it, at any cost, even the cost of our lives. So these people listening to Jesus teach are already astonished by the power and authority of his teaching. What could be more impressive than that? Well, we see it in the next few verses, verses 23 through 26. In this Capernaum synagogue, Mark writes about the encounter in which the kingdom of God goes head-to-head with its ultimate opponent, an opponent that is often unseen. That opponent is the power of evil, pure evil. This is truly the acid test of Jesus' authority, right? If the powers of evil can't be overcome by the power and authority of Jesus, then again, what is the point of following him? So as Jesus is teaching and the people are astonished at his teaching, Mark writes that immediately, there's a word immediately again, there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit. So you can picture Jesus teaching, all of a sudden this guy comes in, and he has an unclean spirit. There's no indication that this was a regular occurrence, that this demon-possessed man was known in the area of the synagogue. We simply don't know. But it's not a stretch to think that Jesus' teaching evoked a demonic disturbance. Mark's description of the demon as an unclean spirit is used 11 times throughout this book. The demon is used 13 times. Unclean, as you would imagine, the Jewish perspective means ungodly, polluted, contaminated, devoid of all moral purity, foul by nature, not a glamorous description at all. The demon refers to itself in the plural. This was either referring to itself and its host, the man in this case, Or, and I think this is more likely considering the context, the demon knows that Jesus' mission is not simply to defeat one demon, but to lay waste the entire demonic power structure. And there's a reason I think this. The Greek word for rebuked in verse 25 that's used by Mark is epitimon. From H.C. Keyes, the terminology of Mark's exorcism stories, some good reading there. This is a technical term in Judaism, and I quote, by which evil powers are brought into submission, and the way is thereby prepared for the establishment of God's righteous rule in the world. Let me read that again. By which evil powers are brought into submission, and the way is thereby prepared for the establishment of God's righteous rule in the world. That's the word that was used. Mark uses this in two additional exorcisms in chapters 3, verses 7 through 12, and chapters 5, verses 1 through 20, to depict the conflict between the kingdom of God and the dominion of Satan, between the one anointed with God's Spirit and those held captive by unclean spirits. According to Mark, the introduction of God's kingdom in Jesus first begins in the supernatural arena. As supernatural powers themselves, the demons recognize the mission and authority of Jesus before humanity does. We see this here in verse 24, and we'll see it again in chapter 3 and chapter 7 and chapter 5. The demon says in verse 24, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." In this passage, the demons become the second party in Mark's presentation of Jesus. Following the voice from heaven at his baptism that Bill taught on last week in verse 11, to announce Jesus as the divine Son of God. Again, these are representatives of two polar opposite realms: perfection, holy perfection, and pure evil. They could do nothing else but repel each other. And the demon knows who Jesus is, and his instinctive expression is that he's doomed. "Have you come to destroy us?" he asks. This isn't a question. It's acknowledgement of his situation. He was toast. The demon knows this as truth. It testified to the true character of Jesus, his enemy, and he knew Jesus to be sinless and pure, but also completely consecrated to God and sent by the Father to destroy the works of evil, the works of Satan, and designated Jesus the Holy One of God, acknowledging Jesus' true deity. The demon's clearly conscious of his own unholy nature. The demon's recognition and confession of the deity of Jesus Christ stands in amazing contrast to the blindness of the people around him, including his disciples. But Jesus wastes no time in putting this unclean spirit in its place. To have accepted any proposal from the demon would have exposed Jesus to the charge of being in league with Satan. It would have been a spurious charge, of course, but it still would have been there. Therefore, any thought of a compromise was swiftly rejected, and Jesus commanded the spirit be silent and come out of him. Verse 26 explains what happened next. And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying out with a loud voice, came out of him. The spirit displayed a final burst of demonic rage, convulsing its host and letting out a strong emotional outcry, further demonstrating its degraded, vicious nature. Verse 27 records the local reaction to these events. This is from the people there in the synagogue who have just witnessed these things. First, Jesus' power-laden, authoritative preaching, causing those hearing it to be astonished. Secondly, the exorcism caused further astonishment. The text reads, they were all amazed, not just the folks in the front row, rather everybody. There was clearly a strong emotional reaction here. So you can picture the scene of people turning to one another after all this just went down, everyone in awe of what happened, asking each other what they thought about what just happened. And Mark records the general reaction of the gathering. People are saying, "What is this? A new teaching with authority. He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." Clearly, this was not any given Sabbath. Something special just happened, something new, something never heard before, never seen before. The people were surprised and astonished, not only because Jesus' teaching was new and fresh in its quality, but the real surprise was the note of authority, authority that even extended to the demonic world. I read that Jewish exorcists pretended by charm or invocation to drive away evil spirits. It was a long process, and it was not typically effective. So clearly, what this audience just witnessed was truly amazing. He commanded the demon with words, and they could do nothing but obey. So a quick recap. Jesus just starts his ministry, calls four disciples from the shores of Lake Galilee, teaches things never heard before in the synagogue, and he casts out a demon. Mark is escalating the reality of Jesus' authority through these passages. And there's more to come as we keep going with this study. But there's more foreshadowing here as well. It's easy to look over the man who is possessed by the unclean spirit, but remember, his life was drastically changed by this act. By this act of Jesus. He was no longer under the control of evil. He was no longer broken, but wholly restored in the image of his Creator. He was healed. So what's the result of everything that just happened? Verse 28 wraps up this passage with the result of just these first few days of Jesus' ministry. Actually, it might have been less than a day. Verse 28, and at once his fame spread everywhere throughout all the surrounding region of Galilee. Jesus immediately, there's the word again, immediately, raised his reputation among all that heard about it. Remember, Capernaum was near a busy, very busy trade route within the region. This would be a front page news story with 2-inch type above the fold headlines. People would be talking about what just happened. Those people would tell other people about what just happened. Before long, the entire region would have heard about this, and in fact, they did hear about it. Remember the term I used earlier, exousia, the Greek word often used to describe supernatural powers and authorities, especially God and his works. And that's really the root of what makes this so astonishing, the reason people were astonished at what was being done and said. Jesus has supreme power and authority. And he uses it to redeem people, to redeem the persecuted Roman Christians under Nero, to redeem us. And if we zoom out, look at the big picture of Jesus' time on earth, this is just one small example of it here. This is just the introduction. We're not even done with chapter one of this book yet. So yes, there is a cost of following Jesus, but it's not enough. It can never be enough because he is the Holy Son of God. And this idea will unfold for us as we continue our study through Mark, which I hope you will continue to be a part of. And that's all I have for this morning. Thank you.